Just a reminder, today's conference is being recorded.
Okay.
Okay, I'm ready to go.
All right, well, good afternoon, everybody. This is Rachel Wohl. I'm the Director of MACRO, the State's Mediation and Conflict Resolution Office, and we are thrilled to have David Smith on this teleconference today, who's the National Education Outreach Officer for the United States Institute of Peace. I've known David for quite a while. I think when I first met you were teaching in the peace program at Harvard.
Right. Well, first of all, Rachel, I'm very pleased to be here and glad to have this opportunity to talk about the work of the Institute with the MACRO audience. I have a strong affinity to Maryland practitioners and MACRO, as you're indicating, because my roots are in Maryland, and I think, well, we met 12, 13 years ago when I was teaching at Harford Community College. And even before then, before I was teaching conflict resolution and peace studies, I also taught at Goucher College. I was a family mediator in the early days of the profession, and it's evolved quite a lot since then. So I'm glad to be here.
Yeah, and I also remember when you got a Fulbright and went to Estonia to teach.
Right. In 2003, I taught at the University of Tartu. In Tartu, Estonia, I taught peace studies at the undergraduate level, and then in the law school, I taught a basic ADR course, which was a quite unfamiliar concept to Estonians, but hopefully I left some sort of a lasting impact, I would hope.
Yeah. And you're a mediator and a lawyer, and are you teaching now at George Mason?
Yes, I'm teaching at ICAR, which is the Institute for Conflict Analysis and Resolution. There's a graduate certificate program. A lot of master's degree programs have already started certificate programs in addition to that, and I teach at the one there. Yeah.
What does that mean, a certificate program at ICAR?
Well, if you think of a master's degree as a degree that gives you a degree of a master's of art, master of science, roughly 30 to 40 credit hours, often certificates are half of that or a quarter of that, if you will. That is a quarter of the number of courses. So you might be taking 3 or 4 courses rather than 10 or 12 courses, and they tend to be designed for individuals who already have advanced degrees. Often, for instance, I know a lot of lawyer JDs who go back and get certificates, individuals with master's degrees go back. So it's a way of kind of developing a conflict resolution dimension to what you're doing without the necessity of going and getting an entire another master's degree, say, in the field, like from University of Baltimore or from ICAR.
Right. And are the courses like weekends and night? I mean, are they designed for working people or?
Yes. The program at ICAR is a little bit of both. The course that I teach is the introductory course. And when I teach it, I teach it in January and February, and I teach it over a number of weekends. And the weekend could be Saturday or it could be Saturday and Sunday. So it's really designed for people who are working in the field.
Okay, I just wanted to spend a little time on that because I think some of our listeners might be interested in getting a certificate from ICAR.
Yeah, I mean, there's the program at ICAR. I know in Maryland, of course, there's a master's degree program at the University of Baltimore, and there's also a master's degree program at Salisbury University. And I don't know if those two programs have also started certificate programs, but I know they're very good master's degree programs.
Yeah, I do as well. I don't know if they have certificates.
Yeah, yeah.
So, David, when I mention the United States Institute of Peace to folks, they go, huh? So I think there are a lot of people that just don't know anything about it. So could you talk a little bit about what it is, the mission?
Sure. And I think that is a typical reaction, I think. The Institute is not well known in U.S. environments. So let me give you a really short synopsis of the Institute and then leave the rest through questions. We can talk more about it. The Institute was established in 1984, and we are established by Congress. We are funded by Congress, and we are operated under congressional authority. The Institute was actually established as a result of a National Peace Academy movement in the 1970s. There was the Matsunaga Commission appointed by Jimmy Carter to look at establishing an institute. And so when we were established in 1984, we were given very a strong education identity, but really we were charged with covering the entire waterfront of international conflict resolution and peace building. And that's the one thing I always want to say, is that we work on international issues, not domestic issues. We are located in Washington, D.C. We've been in Washington for 25 years. Programmatically, we really cover a wide range of activities. We conduct education, we fund, we provide grants, we do training around the world. We are a think tank in the traditional sense that we do research and publishing our own materials. But in the U.S. audiences, we're not well known, except for our education efforts. We have a national peace essay contest that we run in U.S. high schools. But for the most part, we're not known in U.S. audiences because we work overseas for the most part. That will probably change very shortly, I would hope, because in March we're moving to a national headquarters near the National Mall.
What's that about?
Well, about 10 years ago or so, we had been operating in a series of office buildings in Washington, and the president of the Institute, Dr. Richard Solomon, was urged by members of Congress and our friends on the Hill to think about a permanent headquarters for us. We were doing very important work, but when you're in office buildings, you're often hard to get to, and you're not really rising to the level that you need to rise. So we were able to obtain a piece of property near the National Mall at 23rd and Constitution Avenue. So we're not technically on the mall, we're just outside of the mall, where we're building a national headquarters. Congress gave us one.
That's next to the Lincoln Memorial?
Lincoln Memorial and the State Department. So if you're looking, if you're walking to the mall towards the west, you'd see the Lincoln Memorial. And, you know, to the right is the Vietnam War Memorial, and to the left is the Korean War Memorial. Well, to the far right, if you're looking west, across Constitution Avenue, is where our building is now. Actually, the exterior of the building is, for all intents and purposes, is done. It's just the interior we're working on. And we're, in a sense, next to the State Department, which is across 23rd Street from us, and then some other buildings on that end.
So you're going to be more prominent, really, on the mall or close to the mall.
Yeah, I think part of it for us is elevating the work that we do, but elevating the intention of Americans to support the work that we do. In a sense, you know, we are the U.S. Institute of Peace because Congress and the American people believe that this is a very important mission that we're involved in, and many people don't know that we're involved in this. So the idea of having this building is not only serves our operational purposes, that is, it's a place where we will have our offices and we will convene the field, and but it also is symbolic in that it is a place that people can identify as being an address for peace building, in a sense. They will know that there is a place in Washington that focuses on that. Even though our focus is international, I think in a way the building is a symbol for the entire field. And one other thing about the building that's important is that eventually the building will have what we're calling a global peace building center, which is an education center. So eventually the building will have a space where young people, internationals, diplomats, middle schoolers, you know, the whole range of individuals that come on the mall can come and learn about the work of global peace building and can have that educational experience.
Fantastic. I know you're primarily overseas, but you also do some work in the United States, yeah?
Right. Our work in the United States has traditionally been limited to education and training. And education in that working with higher education and secondary education in the U.S. So, for instance, a lot of the work that I've done has been working with colleges and universities around the United States in trying to help colleges and universities think about how to teach about global peace and conflict resolution. So I've traveled, I've traveled to 24 states. I've worked with about 150 colleges and universities in a more of a consulting capacity and to give them ideas on what they could do. We also run a lot of programs out in the field also in colleges and universities around the U.S. So we've often gone to places that have invited us and developed a thematic approach, maybe working with teachers' colleges. So I'll give you an example of some things we've done lately. The end of June, we were at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, where we ran a two-day workshop for, there's a Title VI center there. Title VI centers are centers that focus on global education or international education. And we were doing something to help the teacher community, the education community in Wisconsin. In February of this year, I was in Dearborn, Michigan. I was at Henry Ford Community College. I've worked a lot with community colleges. And I spent 2 days running a program in that community, which is a very Arab community, very predominantly Arab Muslim community, in teaching about peace and conflict and looking at how conflict overseas may influence conflict at home and how peace at home can be taken overseas in a sense. So those are the types of things we've done out in the field educationally. Now we're doing more and more things in Washington, and the big thing that we're really focusing on is the education of practitioners. Through our period of being in Iraq and being in Afghanistan, one of the things that we have realized is that there is a need to focus on better preparing mid-level practitioners who go work in the field. And we're talking about diplomats, members of NGOs, educators, particularly military. And over the last couple of years, increasingly groups would come to us and say, you know, we would like to get training on peace processes or negotiation or working with cultural groups and so forth. We were getting so much business that we really felt that we needed to form an academy. So 2 years ago, we formed an academy for international conflict management and peace building. So those are the things that we've been focusing mostly on domestically.
I'm going to go back and ask you
sure.
about sort of the educational offerings you have that
okay.
might interest our audience,
okay,
that
sure.
they might have access to.
Sure,
but first,
sure.
You mentioned, you know, working with the Islamic community, mm-hmm. and, you know, we all know about this disturbing growth of Islamophobia in this country, and I'm wondering, are you doing any work in that realm?
Well, our work is designed to raise awareness of peace and conflict issues broadly. And we are often working in very culturally defined communities. So we may be working in Islamic communities. We may be working in African communities. We may be working in Asian communities and so forth.
Uh-huh.
I think from our standpoint, what we would argue is, you know, terrorism is an instrument, is a means that's used by people who are trying to cause havoc around the world, clearly.
Uh-huh.
Islam is not terrorism. Islam is a faith. To be Muslim is to be a practitioner of that. And like every faith, there are many, many good, wonderful things that come from that particular faith. So one of the things that we would want people to understand is that there's a distinction between bad people who do things irrespective of what religion or faith they practice and the many good people who are practice their faith, be it Islam or Christianity or Judaism and so forth. So, you know, our work is to kind of focus on those positive things that are coming out of these faith-based communities. For instance, we have a religion and peacemaking emphasis in a center here at the Institute where we have focused a lot on bringing, for instance, in Iraq and to some extent in other parts of the Muslim world, bringing Shiite and Sunni leaders together. And helping them bridge the gap, looking, for instance, at Abrahamic religions, looking at Christianity and Judaism and Islam and seeing where the commonalities are and building from that.
Mm-hmm. Great. So back to the courses
mm-hmm.
that USIP
sure.
offers that might interest the Maryland audience.
Yeah. There are two things that I would suggest. One is a really easy thing, and this is on our website. I think a lot of people don't realize that we have a number of courses right on our website that people can work on from their home, in a sense. These are online distance education courses, which we have we've had operating for a number of years. And so we have one on, these are certificates that we offer online, so it's not the same type of certificate we were talking about before. So we have a certificate course in conflict analysis. We have a certificate course in interfaith conflict resolution, and these are courses, and we have a few others, and these are courses you can go right to our website and do from anywhere around the world.
Do you want to give your website?
Sure. Well, our website is www.usip.org, but if you go to www.usip.org/education-training, then you will go to where we offer our courses online, and you will find the certificate course in conflict analysis, the certificate course in interfaith conflict resolution, and then some others we're developing. And our courses online are increasingly in other languages. So, for instance, our conflict analysis course is not only in English, it's in Arabic, it's in Farsi, and it's in Spanish. So that's one thing, that, and that's free. And if
Let
you take
just repeat that. It's
www.usip.org/education-training, and that should take you to the website.
Okay.
Now, the other thing that we're doing for I think that what this is really valuable, this course.
Can I just ask one question about those courses? Are they free?
They're free.
Oh, fantastic.
Take you 3 or 4 hours to do. You get a certificate at the end. I mean, I think for a lot of, one of the things that I find is a lot of practitioners are well aware of their own work and have a good grounding in practice, but often would want to have a better grounding in theory and understand how theory works. And what these courses that we're offering do is, work at practice, but we're not doing practice stuff online necessarily, as really exploring theory and how theory works with practice. So, for instance, practitioners in the local community who are really interested about international issues and may even want to pursue international work. They think about themselves in beyond their own community and working with, for instance, an organization like Mediators Beyond Borders or organizations like that that really are supporting domestic practitioners and trying to get them to think about the international, an online course can be beneficial. The other thing,
and let me just stop you there. People are interested in learning more about Mediators Beyond Borders or in joining the organization.
Yep.
That's at www.mediatorsbeyondborders, all one word, .org. So that's www.mediatorsbeyondborders.org. Okay.
Yeah, and MBB is a classic organization for us to work with because, in a sense, it gives us an opportunity to support the domestic community through our own work and through MBB in trying to get domestic folks to think about how they can contribute internationally.
On the board of MBB, and it's we're really also now beginning a big focus on training domestic practitioners, to do international work. So our next Congress, which will be in the first weekend in March in L.A., is going to focus on training. Go ahead.
That's wonderful. The other thing is our Washington-based Academy for International Conflict Management and Peacebuilding, which we started about 2 years ago. Now, at this point, those courses are site-based. That is, you have to come to the Institute to take them.
Mm-hmm.
They are also at the same website I gave before, and our fall schedule is up. So if you went there, you would see that our first courses start on September the 13th.
Yeah.
These courses tend to be about 40 hours in length. They tend to be compressed, and they are, for the most part, at our location in Washington. Increasingly, we will be offering those courses in a distance education format. And eventually, when we will go to our new building, and this would, of course, come with our new building, we're going to have a special location behind our new building. We're converting two old Navy buildings to become this academy. This academy is also something that practitioners might think about. It's not free. There is a cost. It's $195. Practitioners have to be accepted into the course because we're looking for a certain type of student who would be applying this in the field. But if people are interested in that, what I would suggest that they're doing is emailing me at dsmith@usip.org. And then I can direct that individual to the appropriate person in the academy who can help them think about a course that might work for them.
Okay. Maybe we should stop at this point just to check in and see if anybody has questions. And again, if you're on star 6 mute, you need to star 6 again to ask a question. Any questions for David?
I'd like to get that website, the education.
Sure.
Training, you said USIP.
It's www.usip.org/education-training.
Okay.
And that will take you to that website. And that's that would give you to both the online courses I mentioned and also the Academy courses that I mentioned. They're all right there.
Okay. And the students that you say that you are looking for in the Academy, does it outline that on the website?
Yes, it gives you some sense of what we're looking for and the approach that we're taking for creating, you know, our student body and what we're trying to accomplish. For the most part, we're looking to get people who are going to be deployed in the field, who are working in the field. That doesn't preclude domestic practitioners, but I think you have to make the argument that you are going to be working in the field. I must tell you, a number of MBB members have taken courses with us.
Yeah.
So, if you're a domestic person and you say, I want to go work with Mediators Beyond Borders, and I know MBB's got a project, and I think you have a project in Liberia, among several places, and you say, this is what I want to do, then that might qualify you to take the course. But I'm not. I don't decide who gets in the course and not. And it's determined by the instructor based on the needs of the particular individual who wants to take the course.
And MBB, Mediators Beyond Borders, has projects in Liberia, Israel, Zimbabwe, Sierra Leone, Nepal, Colombia, South America, Colombia, and Ecuador.
Yeah. I'll just give you the titles of some of the courses that are coming up so that our audience can get a sense of what we're focusing on. One of the courses that we're offering next week is Rule of Law. It focuses on how can legal programs assist in conflict-affected states? So, looking at promoting legal reform, constitution-making, we're thinking about conflict resolution in a very broad context here. A society that's after a war situation, one of the things that falls by the wayside fairly quickly is its legal system. How would you bring the legal system back? Another course that's coming up in October is engaging with identity-based differences. So many conflict zones, one of the certainly characteristics of lots of very, very divisive violence is parties, groups that have different identity and very pronounced differences. How do you work in that environment? We have a course in October on foundations of conflict analysis, looking at conflict analysis in the international context. What are the theories? What are the approaches that are used in looking at understanding conflict? So, and the website has all of the courses listed.
So, is most of the work that you do overseas through grant-funded projects or your own projects?
That's a good question. So, the Institute, when we were established, we were first really established to do more thinking and to give grants. And our own projects, our own programmatic work as an institute really started more recently. So let me talk about our grants. We give away, we're funded to the tune of about between $30 and $40 million a year. And I say million, not billion. So it's $1 million. And that's not a lot of money in Washington, but it works for what we need to do. About a fourth of that budget we give away every year. We give away through grants. We have two grant processes. One is what we call a priority grant process, which means that an individual can apply for a grant at any time during the year, but the grant has got to focus on one of the conflict zones that we have prioritized as being important. Now, understandably, Iraq, Afghanistan are two of those zones, but so is Pakistan, one of those zones. And other parts of the world are places where we are holding as important places for people to work and that we want to promote work in that area. In addition, we have an annual grant.
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but I'm wondering, is there an average amount that you give out as a grant?
Generally, our grants fall in the $40,000 range. That's the average amount of grant money that we give. Just to tell you, our priority grants right now are Afghanistan, Iran, Iraq, Pakistan, and Sudan. And you can apply for a grant in those areas any time of the year. But the more popular program is our annual grant program, our annual grant competition, which is open for any conflict zone around the world, anything that you would define as peace building. And really, peace building is a broad interpretation for us. It could be media, it could be education, it could be, you know, dialogue, it could be very applied. And that deadline is October the 1st, though. So, and both of those application process are discussed on our website. And once again, if people had an idea for a grant, they certainly could email me and I'll help send it to the right individual for them to look at. So those are the ways that we fund. Now, we also do our own work. So in a sense,
Before you move on, I'm just wondering if you could draw the distinction between mediation, practice, and peace building.
Okay. I would argue, and we would argue here at the Institute, is that peace building is an all-encompassing approach to building capacity and creating stability and peace in a society. It used to be there was a notion that peace building existed in kind of post-conflict societies, but we've kind of taken the idea that it exists throughout a society. So peace building is the full range of activities that help processes, help build civil society, help give people nonviolent options in order to promote the common good and to bring stability in our society. So, you know, mediation is very applied. It's people sitting down at the table, or it could be a broader process, clearly. Well, peace building, much broader than that, could be an education program. It could be providing a media effort in order to get young people to think about peace. It could be setting up dialogues between individuals who are Sunni and Shiite to sit down at the table. It could be, raising awareness of a particular issue. All of those are peace-building processes because the objective at the end is a society that is stable, a society that can handle its own issues without resorting to violence. Mediation and conflict resolution applied sense is very much a part of that, but it's not the only thing that's in there.
You're looking more at sustainability,
right, and social change. Right, right.
I would
cite John Paul Lederach's work, for instance. He has actually looked at peace building as an aggregate activity that exists throughout a society. In some of his most recent work, I think he's got even a strategic peace building model on the web somewhere, probably at the Kroc Institute at the University of Notre Dame.
Yeah.
And it talks about what he means by that. So, peace building is people who are working to support human rights. It's people who are mediating. It's people that are supporting education. It's the whole range of actors that are trying to create sustainability in a society where the society doesn't go back to war.
Right. Okay. So I think you were heading towards giving us a case study, maybe.
Well, let's talk about what we do overseas. So we have grants that we give. And, talking about kind of recent grants that we've given, we have a newsletter that comes out every three or four times a year called Peace Watch, and our most recent Peace Watch, which you can access from our website, focuses on gender, focuses on working with women. The previous Peace Watch focused on youth. So some of the things that are featured in that Peace Watch people can read about, and I'm just pulling up some things that we're highlighting. One is we've recently started to work with an NGO in Iraq that is helping to improve reconciliation through women who are widows, using widowhood as the loss of a husband, women who identify in that group as really the basis of creating reconciliation between Sunnis and Shiites. So we've had about, I think, 10 to 15 participants in a program. This is a program that we are supporting, I think, in a more direct way than through grants. We're actually working with this group.
And are the widows are both Shiite and Sunni?
Both Shiite and Sunni, and using that common experience, of course, as being a way of bridging the gap between their differences. Looking at some of the other programs that we're dealing with, and here's a grant program that I thought was interesting. We do a lot of work in the Niger Delta. So the Niger Delta, people may know, is a really a hotbed of conflict. A lot of it has to do with the imbalance between the oil companies in that region and the local populations, issues related to corruption within the government, and so forth. So here, once again, we funded a program where we're working with an NGO in the Niger Delta to enhance women's participation in conflict resolution processes. Women in many parts of the world take a back seat. They don't they don't participate in these processes. It's male driven, and sometimes it's cultural, and sometimes there are other circumstances. But creating a training for these women so that they know about how to engage in a political process. I mean, often we're training people to do the things that we take for granted as Americans, you know, to know that they can assemble, that they know that they can get together, that they know they can petition for change. And in this case, we're working with women in the Niger Delta to do that. So those are two things that we're doing overseas.
Are you involved in the Consensus Building Institute's project in the Niger Delta?
No. And I know that project. Actually, both you and I were at the ACR conference and International Day talked about that. We're not directly involved in that. I'm aware of it. And one of my colleagues here, Juni Asuni, who was a Jennings Randolph Fellow here until recently, has worked a lot in the Niger Delta. And in fact, I don't think she's worked with CBI, but she knows about their work. There are a lot of people doing good work in the Niger Delta. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I know that you've spent a lot of time overseas, you know, the Estonia Fulbright, but also you spend a lot of time in India and other places. Can you talk really about your own impressions of where things are internationally with regard to conflict and peace building?
Sure. Well, I probably have not spent nearly as much time overseas as most of my colleagues, I would first say. I have colleagues at the Institute that I would dare say spend nearly half of the year overseas, and they're working in the hotbeds of conflict. They're working in South Sudan, they're working in Baghdad, they're working in Kabul, they're working in some very difficult places doing some very important work. My work is domestic while at the USIP. I have traveled overseas, and I traveled, you know, I spent 6 months in Estonia, but I traveled a bit to India, for instance. I mean, that's kind of the other place that I know a little bit about. And one of the things that's interesting about India is that we should understand that India is a very complex, a very diverse environment. It is the world's largest democracy, and for the most part, is a democracy that operates very well. But there is some serious conflict within India, and the conflict is not only at the geopolitical level, like in Kashmir, and also with Malis insurgencies in part of India. It really also is a kind of the basic micro level between Hindus and Muslims and Christians and so forth at that level.
Uh-huh.
I was in India 2 weeks ago, earlier this summer, and I was, one of the things I go is, when I go is I kind of notice what's going on, and I was really impressed of the numbers of, for instance, the legal profession and how it's gotten together. Looking at the New Delhi Bar, which New Delhi is the capital of India, and that they've developed a very, I thought, very well-developed mediation program that had not existed beforehand. I think conflict resolution is coming late to India, but it's coming nonetheless. I think the challenges are different in India than they may be in the United States, maybe because of the stresses that are existing in the environment, but I think it's coming. And so I'm very hopeful when I go to places and I see things developing.
And Estonia too? Is it?
Well, Estonia is a different environment. The conflict in Estonia or the tensions in Estonia is.
Can you say where Estonia is?
Sure, Estonia is the first of the three Baltic nations. So if you go to the Baltic Sea, and you find, most people can find Finland, Norway, Sweden. If you continue to the east, the first country on the east side of the Baltic Sea will be Estonia, followed by Latvia and followed by Lithuania. Until 1991, these countries were occupied by the Soviet Union, and they'd been occupied by the Soviet Union since about World War II on, basically. They had had periods of independence before then. In Estonia, the tension in Estonia is between Estonians, native Estonians, and the Russian minority that still has lived in Estonia that did not return back to Russia when independence came about in 1991. So there were Russian populations that stayed.
And were they sort of a ruling class or no?
At the time, at the time that the Soviet Union was in power, the Russian minority had more leverage and more clout in the country than the Estonian majority.
Uh-huh.
And particularly in Estonia, Russians came to Estonia to work in the defense industry primarily. And this really happened in the 1950s during the Stalin period, where, in a way, Stalin would only trust Russians to come into Estonia to work in the defense industry. And much of Estonia was off limits. people couldn't travel in parts of the country, certainly not the Estonian majority. So there was a lot of violence, there was a very tense relationship between Estonians and Russians during that entire period. So when the Soviet Union left and Russia became Russia in 1991, many Russians stayed because they'd been living there for years and years in the defense industry. Well, that the minority is in a different position than they were beforehand. Now they really are the minority politically, in a sense, where the Estonian population, which is the majority, then is the dominant political force. So there have been really, many of the tensions in some respects reflect in a way trying to resolve the tensions that already existed, going back many, many years. And now there being a different power relationship, if you will. And many of the Russians, for instance, are the underclass economically. They have not worked into the economy well. I mean, Estonia now is part of the European Union, and that arguably would bring more economy and more prosperity to Estonia. It probably has to the Russian population, but I would say to a lesser extent than it has the Estonian population. So
you mean that the other way? Or?
No, the Russians are not as prosperous as the Estonians.
Right.
And the European Union has helped both Estonians and Russia in Estonia, but Estonians more than Russians.
Gotcha.
And I think a part of that is the Estonians in Estonia were looked more to the West, looked more to Scandinavia, are more high-tech savvy, really developed English-speaking skills, traveled much more, and so forth. So they've really kind of embraced this idea of being European, where the Russians, it's been more difficult. And part of the reason is that Russian population have not been quick to learn Estonian as a language, which is now the national language, because realize that under the former Soviet period, Russian was also the language of the country, and Estonian. So often there's a language difference between the two populations that comes to work. So there's a lot of mistrust. I remember when I was teaching in Estonia, now this has been a number of years when I was a Fulbrighter, that I was teaching a course in ADR in the law school, and I had Estonians and Russians both in the classroom. And I could see the mistrust between Estonians and Russians in trying to talk about specific issues and the way they viewed them very differently. And hopefully that's worked out now. You know, this has been several years since I've been there, and through a process of education that will change over time.
It's so typical now, these cross-cultural tensions. You know, the groups change country to country, but they appear sort of endemic. Is USIP focusing on cross-cultural conflicts in any way?
Well, we go to where the conflicts are, and be they cross-cultural or non-cross-cultural, we're going to be there, and we're going to be in where the most violent ones are. So, would we argue that what's going on in Iraq is cross-cultural? Yes. I mean, it's based on, arguably a Sunni and a Shiite culture that are somewhat different from each other, though they probably have much more in common than we realize.
And also with a relatively recently changed power structure.
Yes, exactly. Right, with the U.S. leaving. So, at its root, there's a cultural component to nearly every conflict everywhere. Even looking at conflict in the United States, if we were to look at race relations in the United States, often we say a shorthand, it's a race issue, but what it gets down to is that there's a dominant culture and there is a culture that is a minority culture or a culture that's dominated within environments. And so the struggle really often has less to do with race in a sense, but more of cultural approaches to living and to doing what they need to do in order to live peacefully, that come into clash with each other.
Mm-hmm. It just seems like the U.S. is fairly constantly at war, and certainly there's been all this deadlock in the Congress.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just wondering what your assessment is of this country's commitment to peace building, and is that affecting your budget or your ability to grow?
Right. Well, I certainly can comment in a more general way, but the Institute doesn't take policy stands, so we don't get involved in specific legislation and so forth. But what I would say is that there's a heightened awareness among at least Americans, and particularly practitioners, of another way, a different approach to resolving conflict. That is, I think the experiences of Iraq, the mistakes in Iraq, especially early on, really demonstrated to us that we had a lot to learn. And actually, people come to the Institute to learn some of those things. So within the international NGO practitioner community there is, I think if more Americans knew about the work
that
we're doing.
I'm sorry to interrupt
you. No, please.
People might not know what an NGO is.
Oh, a non-governmental organization, yeah.
So it's like a nonprofit, but it's
like a nonprofit, right? And we don't use that. It is interesting, Rachel, because overseas you use the word NGO. Mm-hmm. Here you use not-for-profit, and they really are the same, but we do have a different view. Like one of the things I find we use the word conflict resolution in the U.S., but we use the word peacemaking overseas to often describe the same activity. And I think increasingly Americans are starting to become more comfortable with international ways of referring to things. So I think that's important. But I think as Americans learn more about the work of the Institute and the work of the entire conflict resolution field, peacemaking field generally, they will realize that first of all, we're funding a lot of this, that our taxpayer dollars are going to support these initiatives. You know, we're not always funding tanks and guns and so forth. We're often funding people to go on the ground and help negotiate differences, often in very small communities. I like to use the analogy that, you know, we put boots on the ground, but increasingly we're putting sandals on the ground too sometimes,
mm-hmm.
and supporting those types of activities around the world. And I think if Americans realize that work, I think they would take more stock in what we're doing, and they would, support what we're doing and really support broadly all notions of conflict resolution practice, be it domestic or international.
And I interrupted you when you were talking about, you know, not being a partisan organization,
right.
And that, in fact, the heat up of situations like Iraq, Afghanistan causes people at the congressional level to turn to your organization.
Mm-hmm.
Was there anything more you wanted to say?
No. One of the things, it's interesting. We've been asked to do some very interesting things, and the thing that was the most significant that we were asked to do, and this was 4 years ago, was the Iraq Study Group, the Iraq Study Report. And if you remember, at that point, we were the previous administration had a policy in Iraq that people were really questioning, why aren't we doing more diplomacy, negotiation, bringing in people from the outside, and so forth. So members of Congress came to the Institute and said, look, you're a nonpartisan, bipartisan, if you will. You're not part of the executive branch of government, so you've got this tremendous objectivity and reputation which we've had. Can you support and can you fund or can you basically organize a study to look at an alternative to what's going on currently? So the Jim Baker, who was a former Secretary of State, and Lee Hamilton, who was a former member of Congress, who was also head of the Woodrow Wilson Center, together as co-chair, headed the Iraq Study Group report, of which we basically were the logistical administrative arm of that, which came out and recommended to whoever was listening, including the administration, is you've got to talk to the Syrians, you've got to talk to the Iranians, you've got to do more diplomacy. That's the only way you're going to resolve it. Now, was the Bush administration listening? Did they take our advice? I mean, that's probably open to debate. But I would say that this president read it carefully, and the approach that has been used has been close to what the recommendations that we made in the Iraq Study Group report. So that's the ability that we've been able to do. We've been able to come in, because we're not funded by a partisan group, we're funded by Congress, we really come in, you know, right in the middle there and are able to do something like the Iraq Study Report and make some recommendations that are really thought of very highly.
Interesting. So I'm going to stop again and see if anyone has any questions for David. Again, if you're on mute, hit star 6 again.
Okay.
Your email address, please.
Hello?
My name is Chan, and I have a question as far as students being aware of the Institute. Is literature getting out to the schools and colleges about the Institute, and do you offer scholarships for students who may be interested in international studies?
Well, first of all, where we offer scholarships is in our peace essay contest, so it's not broadly. That is, high school students who enter into the contest, win the award, they win a scholarship. The highest winner, the national winner, is $10,000. That website is www.usip.org/NPEC. If you go to that, you hear about our essay contest, which works in American high schools around the U.S. We usually have several thousand students that enter. It's primarily an activity for 10th and 11th graders, some 12th graders. So, and then on that, if you go to their website, you can see the other activities we're doing in colleges and universities around the U.S.
But is this limited to only getting to some of the high schools and not all the high schools?
No, all American high schools. We work in all American high schools, private, religious, charter, anywhere. You know, it's not. We're of course we're not limiting where we work in the U.S. I think in some respects we could be better known in the U.S. We're a rather small entity. You know, I want to tell people not only are we, you know, a $30 million organization, but we're only about 300 employees, and we're not even those are all employees. Many of those are people that work part time. That you know, when I came here 5 years ago, we were more like 125 employees. So you think about how large the country is. You talk about how much need there is to do this work. We're probably better well known than we realize, but we need to get more well known, and we're hoping that by my talking here, for instance, and doing some of this outreach, that people will look to us more and will be more aware of our work.
So do you actually send people overseas for this conflict resolution?
Yes, we actually, part of our work is sending my colleagues overseas to work in places like the Middle East, in Iraq, in Sudan, in Colombia, and develop programs to resolve conflict in those communities. We also fund other people to do it. We give grants to NGOs, non-governmental organizations, to do the same thing.
Okay. And I noticed that the organization is called the United States Institute of Peace. Have you all thought of changing the name to something like the United States Institute of International or Global Peace?
Well, the name was given to us, you know, with the with our founders and our primarily our Senate sponsors in the 1980s. You know, should they have made a distinction between global and domestic peace? I think people can argue that to some extent. In our mandate, we are very specifically focused on international peace work, but I've not heard anything about changing the name of the organization.
Okay.
It's an interesting idea, though, and part of why I think this work is so important is because more and more we're all global citizens.
Right.
And God knows our children are going to be more and more global citizens. Everything is so interconnected.
Right. We're starting to realize that a little bit too. You know, I think we realize the time in which we were founded in 1984. We know. I mean, I remember 1984, and Rachel probably does too. And think about how different it was back then.
Yeah.
People didn't travel. There was no internet. You know, conflict. We were still in the Cold War. Conflict was not identity based. It was for the most part international between nation states rather than within a country. The whole world was very different. So it was easy at that point to say, well, this is international, this is domestic. You know, we had domestic issues in the 1980s, clearly. But there was no argument that people could make easily that our international stuff was really, our domestic stuff was informed by international events. There was no crossover. Now, 30 years later, we can make that argument quite often, that there is crossover, that we have communities where there's violence, and often you can see where the violence may have come from overseas. So we've really, I think, tried to stretch ourselves a bit and tried to work with, for instance, ethnic groups in the United States, for instance, working with the Arab community in Dearborn, Michigan, or working with ethnic groups, the Sudanese community in the U.S. and other groups, but in the United States to help work with them to resolve conflicts overseas. So I think one of the things that we will continue to be focusing on is, you know, not so much this very pronounced divide between the international and the domestic, but really how we can resolve global conflicts no matter where they might be. And sometimes we can be doing that work in the U.S.
Great. Well, I think we're supposed to wrap up
okay.
now. Are there any more questions?
Well, I have another question. It's about when you send groups overseas to try to solve conflicts, do you have to get approval from the State Department, or what government entity do you work closely with?
Actually, when we go overseas, first of all, when we go overseas, we're invited by partners, and this is very important to know, that we are not just deciding we're going to go somewhere. It's very important that we have local people that are inviting us, and I think, for instance, MBB operates this way too, I think, that we want people to be supporting other people's efforts in the country. We're generally going into places where there's free access, that, you know, they're not stringent visa requirements and so forth. To get in and to get out, for that matter. I mean, there are some places that are more dangerous than others, and, you know, we're not necessarily operating in the most difficult, dangerous environments. So, for instance, we don't have any programs right now that are operating in Mogadishu in Somalia, which is a very dangerous environment right now. So we're very cognizant of where we should be and not be.
Okay.
Okay. Any other questions?
Okay. Well, David, it's. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, I'm here. Fine. Unless there's another question.
I thought I heard something, someone's voice, but perhaps not.
Okay.
I have one more, but I mean, I don't know.
Sure. Please go ahead.
Like I'm asking.
You've got the floor.
Well, okay. So if the U.S. Institute of Peace can work on domestic problems too, does it work against eliminate these hate groups in America? Does it work?
Well, but let me go back. We're not working on domestic problems.
Okay.
We're working in the United States insofar as what we're working on is really a global or an international problem.
Okay.
And I would say hate groups, for instance, what's going on in the U.S., is not something we're working on. Now, there are groups like the Southern Poverty Law Center works on issues such as that, which is based, I think, in Montgomery, Alabama. There are local groups that look at that. The Anti-Defamation League looks at those issues in the U.S. But it would not be us doing that, because even though we could be operating in the U.S., we're looking at international issues.
Okay.
Okay.
All right.
All right, then.
Well, thank you so much, David. I know I'm going to be checking out your website and looking at your educational offerings, and I imagine many other people on the line are going to do the same.
If people want to, you know, email me with any additional questions, it's dsmith@usip.org, and I am I get back to every email within a day. So nothing is slowed on my end. So any question you have, and if I don't have an answer, I'll send you to someone in the Institute that can help you, or even send you outside the Institute. I think it's, you know, we all work in the same field. We all need to support each other's activities. And so any way that I can facilitate that, I try to do that.
Terrific.
Okay.
Thanks so much, David.
Okay. All right, Rachel. Okay. Thank you then. All right.
Look forward
Bye-bye.
To talking to you again.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Then. Bye-bye.
Thanks for tuning in, everybody. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.